Lights from ambulances and cop cars flashed blue, red, blue, falling over us and the double lines of soldiers that stood between us and hundreds, if not thousands, of people. I blinked, trying to clear my thoughts. This was right. This was how it was supposed to be. Alice would have released her last blast of information during the assault, including the names of the children at Thurmond and a location where they could be retrieved. I'd assumed that it would also give the military time to respond, and I'd been right. The soldiers, National Guard, police, and PSFs alike had assumed a defensive stance, shielded by riot gear.
"Drop your weapons! Get down on the ground and place your hands on your head," the same man ordered. "Any further advancement will be seen as a sign of hostile aggression, and we will open fire."
We kept moving forward, toward the men and women in camouflage, toward the few in black PSF uniforms, until we were less than 300 feet away. The tall, clear riot shields formed an actual wall between us, but didn't mask the way the soldiers' eyes flickered over us. The row behind them was armed and primed to do exactly as the officer had threatened. The muzzles of their guns were carefully placed in the gaps of space between the shields. They stood back to back, with a row of FBI and uniformed police officers who were facing the crowd of reporters and civilians. Cameras. There were cameras everywhere, flashing, recording, even as the men and women tried to block the shots or smash the devices altogether. The helicopter's propeller announced its arrival long before it appeared in the sky. Its searchlight swept over us several times, as if scanning for one person in particular. A soldier sat at the edge of the open door, an automatic rifle in his hands, as he took stock of the situation. The officer in charge stood just left of center, behind both lines of soldiers. There was a satellite phone pressed to his ear. He kept ducking in and out of sight, as if crouching down could somehow drown out the noise of the crowd that rose behind him, breaking over all of us in a rush. "Names," I thought, forcing myself to look beyond the weapons and the gear, to the faces of regret and hope behind them. One of the kids behind me recognized one of them, clearly, because she surged forward with a shout of, "Mom! Mom!"
"Get down on the ground and put your hands behind your head," the officer yelled into the bullhorn. "Do it now! Now!"
"Here!" a woman shouted back. "I'm here! Emily! I'm here!"
Watching the face of the soldier directly in front of me was like seeing a trickling creek become a river. Emotion roared across his eyes, and not even the glare of the chopper's searchlight could disguise the look he cast back at the woman who was struggling against the three FBI agents pushing her to the ground. The civilians around her pushed back, trying to drive them away from her. The soldier was well past the point of youth. The stubble on his weathered cheeks was silver, matching the heavy brows above his pale blue eyes. He faced forward again, ignoring the uncomfortable shifting of the younger men and women to his left and right as they waited for their next order. His gaze shifted to a girl a few feet away from me. She was crying, still yelling, "Mom! Mom!" Her dark curls stuck to her wet cheeks. The soldier shook his head. Such a slow, simple movement. He shook his head and let the riot shield fall forward into the mud. The sound somehow cut off all others. His own automatic rifle he left on the ground as he straightened up to his full height, chest out and forward, as he dodged the hand of the dumbstruck soldier next to him who'd half-heartedly put an arm out to stop him. He stepped over his own shield, snapping the clips on his Kevlar vest and tugging it off. The helicopter's light found his path and traced it as he came toward us slowly, showing that he was unarmed. He held out his hand to her, and, after a moment of hesitation, she took it and allowed him to draw her forward to drop the vest over her head. His helmet came off next, and though it was too big for her, he clipped it on anyway, adjusting the strap tight under her chin. The soldier picked her up, and she locked her arms around his neck in complete trust. As he carried her back toward the line of soldiers, the officer in charge finally shook off his stupor enough to realize he should be shouting orders. He tried. No one, not a single one of us, listened. I heard my heart in my ears, louder and louder, and held my breath. Holding out an arm, he pushed his way through the soldiers that tried to close the gap he'd left in the line, until finally, the few FBI agents still standing over the woman released her. She met the soldier halfway, tearing the girl out of his arms and into hers. It wasn't until Liam reached up and lightly squeezed the arm I had around his neck that I realized the kids around me were moving again. The crack in the line of soldiers expanded as two kids followed the path they had taken through. Three kids. Four. The officer was shouting into the megaphone, but except for a rare few, the soldiers were lifting their riot shields out of formation and turning to the side. The kids flooded through them, the same way they'd flowed through the trees, finding the openings, gathering their courage close, and passing through them. Vida said something I couldn't hear. My head was too heavy now for my neck to support, and both of them stumbled as my left leg crumpled beneath me. Liam's hands were on my face, forcing my eyes open. It was so cold. How could I be sweating? I was lifted up completely, carried through the crush of families. More than one had thought to make signs with their child's name, using those strange, unthinkable phrases like, "Welcome home," and "We love you." When my eyes opened again, the next face I saw was Chubbs's. The word on his lips was shock. And Kate. There was Kate. Her cheek bruised, tears in her eyes. She held my face between her hands and was talking to me as I was lifted off the ground. The red, blue, white lights stained their skin. I knew we were running, but I couldn't feel anything, even as I was lifted again, higher this time, onto a soft surface. Unfamiliar faces, lights flashing, snapping sounds, voices. Liam. Ambulance. Liam tried to climb into the back with me, but he was forced out as two of the assault team members were loaded on. Two men, one clutching an unnaturally limp arm, the other bleeding profusely at the brow.
"I'll come find you,"
Liam was shouting as he backed out.
"We'll find you."
The EMTs strapped me down, pushing me back onto the stretcher. Liam stood a few feet away and Chubbs had his arms around him, trying to talk him down, hold him in place. He saw the panic surging in him clearly as I had. The doors slammed shut and the siren switched on.
"Tell me your name. Can you tell me your name?"
The EMT was a young woman, her expression serious as she studied me.
"We have a possible transverse fracture of the right tibia. 4, 5, 6 lacerations, ranging from 4 centimeters to 6 on the upper and lower body. Look at me. Can you tell me your name? Can you speak?"
I shook my head, tongue like stone.
"Are you in pain?"
I nodded.
"Blood pressure low, rapid pulse, hypovolemic shock. Can you..."
One of the men on the floor was blocking the drawer she needed to get into, but pried it open with his good arm, passing her what looked like a large sheet of tinfoil. The EMT spread it over me as another put a line in my arm and began bandaging. The strange blanket trapped in a little pocket of warmth. I began to tremble as the pain woke up again.
"What happened to your leg?"
I grunted as she lifted it into some kind of brace.
"Can you tell me what happened to your leg?"
"Hurts," I choked out. She held my face between her hands, and I felt wild, almost unhinged, as I looked into her eyes. "You're okay. You're safe. We're going to take care of you. You're safe." One of the soldiers on the floor reached up, his blood-stained hand coming to rest softly over my wrist.
"You're a good girl,"
he said.
"You're a good
Brave girl. You did a good job.
You're safe now, the EMT repeated. We're going to take care of you. The wall I'd built up against the well of pain and fear and anger finally collapsed, and I began to cry. I sobbed, the way I had in the garage of my parents' house on that last morning before they took me. I bawled, because it was such a relief not to have to hold it in any longer, to have to pretend. I didn't have to stay awake when the first pull of peaceful nothing came. 27. For days, I felt like I was trapped inside my own body. There were moments, few and far between, where I could sense I was waking up, coming close to the surface of reality. Unfamiliar sounds, clicking, wheezing, beeps, faces behind blue paper masks, ceilings passing overhead. I had the most vivid dreams of my life, haunted by people I hadn't seen in years. I rode in the front seat of a black van, my forehead against the glass. I saw the ocean, the trees, the sky. In the same way that the earth always hardens again after the rain, I felt myself solidify again, becoming a whole made of pieces. And one morning, I simply woke up to a room full of sunshine. I blinked, body and head heavy and slow, as I turned toward the source of the light. A window, the curtains framing the flowering arm of a nearby dogwood tree. The walls were painted a soothing light blue, a strange contrast to the dark gray machinery beeping and glowing around me. Hospital. I dragged myself up, meeting the resistance of the wires attached to the back of my hand with a few gentle tugs. Someone had draped a thin white sheet over me, and I had to use my left leg to kick it off in order to inspect the new, unexpected weight around the right. A plaster cast. A long flannel pajama shirt. Beneath it, my arms were heavily bandaged, and I felt the pull of tape along my collarbone. I reached up to feel the gauze padding. I let myself relax, listening just for a moment to the sound of the street below, the stream of voices on the other side of the wall. Some part of me knew that I should be afraid, but I was too exhausted to try. When I couldn't stand the sour, dry feeling of my mouth and throat any longer, I reached for the water glass on the stand nearby and downed it in one go, nearly knocking over a small vase of flowers. There were crutches leaning against the opposite wall, under a TV mounted from the ceiling. But the moment I started to swing my feet over the side of the bed, the door cracked open. I don't know who was more surprised, me or the petite, steel-haired woman who stepped inside with a small tray of food. Green eyes widened.
You're awake!
She shut the door quickly behind her, then turned back to me, absolutely glowing. I stared at her, devouring the sight. She mistook my silence for distress, or confusion, I thought, because she quickly set the tray down and dragged a nearby chair over.
Do you know who I am?
The word burst out of me. Grams! She grinned, taking my hand and holding it between her soft, paper-thin skin. For a long time, we did nothing but study each other. Her face was softer now, and she'd let her dark hair lighten completely. But there was this look of mischief in her eyes that was so uniquely hers, I felt myself choke up at the sight.
You've seen some trouble, haven't you?
I nodded, and she leaned over and kissed my forehead.
You're here, I repeated, somehow dumbfounded by this. You found me. Little girl, after they took you, we never stopped looking for you. The moment they released the list of children and the location of the camp, we were in the car speeding straight for you. It took us hours to find out which hospital you were in. You had quite the crowd guarding you. They almost didn't let me and your folks in.
I shook my head, unable to process this. They don't remember me.
No, they don't. It's very odd, but they... How do I say it?
They can't drum up the details, but you've always been there, deep down. Not here, she said, tapping her forehead. She moved her hand down to cover her chest. Here. I almost couldn't get the words out. Do you know what I am? Well, for starters, you're my darling, precious girl who can do something a little peculiar with her mind, she said, her soft southern accent stronger than ever. You also seem to be somewhat of a media darling. I sat back at that, suspicion working a slow path through my mind. Grams held up a finger, walking over to retrieve a newspaper from a purse I hadn't noticed by the door. It's been a feeding frenzy outside of the hospital for days. You have 2 armed guards posted outside of your room at all times, a whole wing to yourself, and still a vulture tried to sneak in and take a photo of you. The New York Times had run with the news of the camp hit and the subsequent fallout. I spread the newspaper out over my lap, apprehension already cutting through my hard-won calm. In the time I'd been gone, Alice's original idea for an information package had changed, blossoming into the complete story of what had happened in Los Angeles and at the ranch. It was pages of her photographs of us, all of us, planning, playing, working. The road code. She'd written about why the deceptions had been necessary and what editors and media bosses had worked with us to cover up the truth until the Thurmond camp hit began. There was a long profile of Cole, his face grinning up at me in black and white. And then there was the piece about me. While she hadn't gone into any details about my abilities, Alice had deprived readers of pretty much nothing else. I was at the edge of many of her photos, just out of frame, face hidden by shadows or hair. The others, Kate especially, must have filled her in on how I'd escaped Thurmond in the first place, what my life had been like on the run and with the League, and then how I'd been willing to go back to the camp to help them. The paper had run photos of me being carried to the ambulance, but Liam's face was out of the shot. It might as well have been a completely different person because I didn't recognize that small, pale girl at all. I shrank back against the pillow, feeling exposed under Graham's watchful eye. There's more, if you'd like to read it, she said, taking the paper away. Not now, I said. Has anyone else? Grams walked the paper back across the room and took up her tray of hospital food again, settling it over me. Has anyone else what? Been by? I mumbled. To visit? Grams gave me a knowing smile. A charming young woman with a mouth that could give a sailor a heart attack? A sweet little one who brought you flowers? The one who spent half a day chasing doctors and nurses around, demanding answers about your condition? Or, by any chance, are you referring to a very well-mannered southern boy? All of them, I whispered. Are they here? Not at the moment, Graham said. They had to go back to the hotel. Everyone's in Charleston for this fancy press conference. But they were here, and they asked me to give you this for when you woke up, so you know how to find them. Grams handed me a folded piece of paper, hotel stationery, as it turned out, with a telephone number scrawled across it. Call as soon as you can. Liam's handwriting. I missed you very much, darling girl, Graham said softly. One day I hope you'll talk to me about what's happened to you. I don't want to read about it. I'd much rather hear it from you. I missed you too, I whispered. So, so much. I wanted to find you. She smoothed the hair back from my face. Do you want to see them now? I didn't need any clarification about who them meant. Do they... I swallowed. Do they want to see me? Oh, yes, Graham said, As long as it's all right with you.
After a moment, I nodded. When she left the room, I balanced my tray on the small table. My heart was hammering in my chest the moment I heard their footsteps. The last time, I thought. This is the last time I'll do this. Grams appeared first, stepping aside to let a slight, frail woman in, followed closely by a salt-and-pepper-haired man. It was remarkable how little I remembered about what they really looked like. Maybe the years had done damage to them the way they had to me, thinning them out, running them back and forth over life's sharp edges. It was so odd to see the shape of my nose on another person's face, my eyes, my mouth, the dimple on my chin. He wore a polo shirt tucked into slacks. She wore a dress, and I had the strange thought that they had dressed up to see me. I wished it didn't feel so painfully uncomfortable, but I could see it in their faces. They looked at me, and all they remembered was the morning I'd been taken away, when they'd forced me out of the house in their confusion. The years stood between us, empty, aching. So I started with the sweetness. A camping trip we had taken a very, very long time ago in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The hike down through the autumn trees, just beginning to change their colors. The air had been crisp and clear, the rolling mountains only a few shades darker than the endless blue sky above. We'd slept together, the three of us, in this little pocket of warmth in our tent, fishing for our food. I'd watched, amazed, as Dad had started the campfire. The knotted memories released with only the slightest touch, as if they'd already begun to unravel on their own. I pulled back from each of their minds in turn, barely able to control my own feelings without the sudden flood of theirs.
"Someone, please say something," Graham said, exasperated.
But I didn't need to say a word. I only needed to let them hold me as they cried. I've heard some people say life can change in a day, completely flipping you feet over head. But they're wrong. Life doesn't need a day to change. It needs three. 3 days for parachutes to start falling from the sky, bringing packages and soldiers in blue United Nations berets into the cities that needed them most. For a small coalition of foreign leaders to step foot on American soil for the first time in 7 years. For Senator Cruz's story to be released, and for her to be chosen to oversee the entire country's restoration process. For the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to resign, shrugging off the shame and collecting his pension. For the armed forces to issue new orders, and to then realize the men and women who'd left their postings were never coming back. For the President of the United States of America to disappear off the face of the earth. For the United Nations to divide the country up into 4 peacekeeping zones, each overseen by a former senator of that region and a foreign power, and send in troops to oversee the policing. For the first of nearly 100 water riots to occur. For Lita Corp to issue a statement denying their involvement in Agent Ambrosia, but oh so generously offering to supply a chemical they claimed could neutralize it. I read about it in the papers my parents brought in, watched it on the news, absorbed this new reality. And that night, when visiting hours were over and 2 kind but firm nurses led my family away, I reached over for the phone on the wall. The painkillers they'd given me were making me drowsy, but I didn't want to sleep without hearing his voice, without making sure they were all okay. I dialed the number and lay back down, the phone cradled between my ear and shoulder. I spun the curling phone cord around my fingers, waiting as it rang, and rang, and rang, and rang. They're probably out, doing something. I tried not to let myself deflate as I started to reach over to hang the phone back up. I could try again in the morning.
Hello?
The voice burst through the connection, breathless.
Hello?
I drew the phone back and smiled as I whispered, "Hi."
Liam let out a soft breath.
It's so good to hear your voice. How are you feeling?
Better now.
I'm so sorry we couldn't stay. Senator Cruz asked us to come back to the hotel. There's been... It's no excuse, but it's been busy. Both Chubbs and Vi said that you'd be mad at us if we didn't go.
They were right. I settled back down on my side. What's been going on? Graham said something about a press conference?
Yeah, for the plan. The big plan. It's been a parade of faces coming in and out. Oh, God, and get this. We have a representative in the deliberations.
Who? I asked. If it wasn't Liam, then who?
Guess who opened his big chubsy mouth and started, in glorious detail, outlining every single thing he thought Senator Cruz should be doing the other night at dinner. It was a magnificent rant.
I closed my eyes, laughing. No, really?
Really. She told him that he had to report to the meeting room the next morning.
Liam continued.
He was either elated or irritated by the honor. Sometimes it's hard to tell with him.
I listened to the sound of him breathing and the silence that followed. Are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah, darling. Everyone's fine,
he said, but there was an obvious strain in his voice.
Mom's getting here tomorrow. She keeps saying that word, too. Fine. I just wish you were here, is all. I'm going to come first thing tomorrow.
No, I said. First thing in the morning, I'm coming to you.
Maybe I'll just have to meet you halfway,
he said, a laugh tucked into the edge of his voice. I listened as he told me about the 100-odd kids who were still waiting to be picked up by their parents. They'd been given free rooms at the hotel, free meals, too, and a veritable army of volunteers had come in with supplies and clothes. He told me about catching Vida and Chubbs getting handsy with each other in the elevator, Zoo's small shrug when she was told her parents had managed to leave the country, and, until they could be contacted, she had a choice. Go home and stay with her aunt, uncle, and Hina, or live with Vida, Nico, and Kate near D.C., so the latter could consult with Senator Cruz. How it hadn't even taken her a second to settle on D.C. I told him about my parents, the way the soldiers posted outside of my door peeked in every time it opened, the way the doctor's hands shook, just a little, as he examined my cuts, and, at some point, I felt myself begin to drift off to sleep.
Hang up. Go to sleep,
Liam said, sounding just as tired. You hang up. And in the end, neither of us did. The next morning, clear on the other side of town, I sat sandwiched between my parents on a couch in the lobby of a Marriott hotel in Charleston, West Virginia. It was a testament to how packed it was that no one, not a single member of the press, seemed to notice me as we sat there. At about a quarter till, the crowds began to migrate toward the elevators to head up to the large conference room. As we waited, Mom kept insisting I needed something, water, a snack, a book, some Tylenol, until finally Dad reached over and placed a calming hand on her arm. I caught him watching me out of the corner of his eye, though, as if he needed to keep checking I was still there. This was how we were warming to each other, slowly, clumsily, earnestly. Grams paced the floor in front of us, and it was only because she stopped that I knew someone was coming. But it wasn't Liam or Vida. It was Kate. Her pale blonde hair had been smoothed back into a neat ponytail, and she was wearing makeup, a dress. She seemed shadowed, somehow, face drawn in a way that made my heart clench. I flew up to my feet, my dad reaching up to steady me as I rocked forward on my walking cast. Her pace slowed somewhat as she saw me, and I was glad when I saw the smile stretch across her face. If she had started crying, I wouldn't have trusted myself not to.
I'm so proud of you, she whispered. You fill me with awe. Thank you.
I hugged her as fiercely as she hugged me, and I was filled to the brim with the warmth of her love. When I finally released her and introduced her to my family, it was clear they were already well aware of who she was. She clasped my hands in hers. "Can we talk later? I need to run upstairs, but I didn't want to go another minute without seeing for myself that you were okay." I nodded, letting her draw me into another embrace. Just as I started to pull back, she said, her voice low, "There's someone here you won't want to see." I had a feeling I knew exactly who she was talking about, and was grateful she had given me a warning ahead of time to prepare myself. Liam, Vida, Nico, and Zoo got off the elevator that she got on. I couldn't stop the broad grin from spreading across my face. Zoo was the first to reach me, a streak of pink dress cutting through the lobby to wrap her arms around my center. Nico hung back, shifting awkwardly between his feet until I urged him over. Vida had no such qualms. She gave me a hard punch to the shoulder, which I think I was supposed to read as playful. And Liam, well aware of my parents' eyes on him, reintroduced himself to them, shaking their hands. He came toward me slowly, giving me time to get a good read on him. His hair was cut and tamed, and he was clean-shaven. If he was tired, it didn't show, but I saw a shadow of grief in his eyes. When he offered a small, shy smile, I returned it, my heart feeling like it was about to leap out of my chest.
"Hello again, ma'am," he said, perfectly polite, as he shook Graham's hand.
She planted a big one on his cheek and turned to me with a wink. When he reached me, Liam simply took my arm and asked,
"Everyone ready to go up?"
It was stupid to feel a pang of disappointment that I hadn't gotten a proper greeting, but my hands were practically burning with the need to run my hands through his hair, smooth the lines from his face. When the elevator doors slid open, I started forward, but he held us in place, allowing my parents, Zoo, Vida, Nico, and about a half dozen others onto the elevator.
"You know what?"
Liam said, waving my dad off when he reached to hold the doors open.
"We'll get the next one."
And the minute the doors slammed shut, his arm slid around my waist, his other hand wove through my hair, and I was being kissed to within an inch of my life.
"Hi,"
he said when he finally came up for air.
"Hi,"
I said, now both dizzy and breathless as he leaned down to rest his forehead against mine. "Do we have to go up?" He nodded, but it was another few moments before he actually reached over and pushed the up button. The press conference had been set up in the hotel's ballroom space, a room that accommodated 100 chairs, 3/4 of which were already taken by the time we got up there. When I saw that the others had saved us seats at the very back of the room, I almost cried in gratitude. Already I was feeling eyes shift toward me, and the uncomfortable feeling would only have been compounded if we'd been in a position for the whole room to stare at the back of my head, if I couldn't make a clean escape if I needed to. Liam seemed to sense this and guided me forward, a hand on the small of my back, to an aisle seat. No sooner had we found our spots than two men, both in military dress uniforms, moved away from us to the other side of the room. Vida gave them a little toothy smile and wave when they glanced back at us again. The room shushed itself into silence as the first people walked out onto the stage. All were men. Some military, some clearly politicians. Those were the ones who remembered to turn and smile for the cameras before sitting down. I released a deep breath as Senator Cruz appeared, followed by Dr. Gray, and then, surprisingly, Kate. Liam's hand found mine as Chubbs walked out, shoulders back, eyes forward. He wore a beautiful navy suit and a striped tie, finishing off the look with new, thin, wire-rimmed glasses.
"Nerd,"
I heard Vida mutter, but she had this pleased little smile on her face. I glanced at Liam and found an expression as grim as mine. It was a fine package Chubbs had wrapped himself in, almost enough to distract me from the look on his face. I'd seen it a dozen times, the chin jutting out, the eyes sullen.
It was the look of someone who had just lost a vote.
Damn,
Liam murmured.
This is going to be bad.
And it was. Thank you for coming here today, Senator Cruz began, speaking without the sheet of notes someone leaned over and placed in front of her. The last 5 days have been a true test of American fortitude, and I believe I speak not only for my former congressional colleagues, but also for our foreign allies, when I thank you for your cooperation as we begin to roll out our recovery phases. The good news is, we're already 8 days into the first.
Cameras click, click, clicked.
I'd like to take the time to walk you through the agreement that we signed this morning. Please save your questions until the very end, when we'll have a few moments to address them. She took a breath, shuffling her papers. The four peacekeeping zones we established will remain in place for the next 4 years. Reconstruction in cities and towns that were decimated by this struggle or by natural disasters for which the government failed to provide aid will be handled by the peacekeeping coalition of countries in each zone, the details of which will be covered in subsequent separate press conferences. She let the audience absorb that before continuing. Each zone will also be responsible for overseeing the neutralization of agent ambrosia in groundwater and wells found within its boundaries, as well as the destruction of any stockpiles of the chemical. Any further use of it throughout the world, as well as any use of Psi-afflicted youth as soldiers, clandestine agents, or government officials in this nation or others is explicitly forbidden by this agreement and will be condemned. Lillian's eyes scanned the room, almost catching mine. She sat up a little straighter and looked pained, clearly knowing what was coming next. Children remaining in rehabilitation camps will be returned to their families over the course of the next month. We will be providing a searchable database to locate where each child is currently residing, but parents will not be allowed access to the camps. As part of our agreement, they will be destroyed. Shock hit me like a blow to the face. The room began to rumble with voices, low conversations, shouted questions, everything in between. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Grams trying to gauge my reaction, but I couldn't bring myself to tear my eyes from the stage. The life-saving operation developed by Dr. Lillian Gray will be provided, free of charge, for as long as this terrible mutation exists in our society. Any Psi-afflicted person over the age of 18 will be allowed to decide whether to opt out of the surgery, but will be required to carry special identification. Whether or not a child under the age of 18 receives the treatment will be left to the discretion of their parents or guardians. Lillian's eyes fell back to the table. We have set aside several miles of land on which to build a community for any unclaimed child or any child who feels as though they cannot return home safely. We will require that all Psi-afflicted citizens who choose not to undergo the procedure live out the remainder of their lives in one of these communities. I must have made some noise of disgust because my family turned to look at me. At that same moment, someone on the stage let out a low, furious,
"That is bullshit."
And that someone was Chubbs.
"Hold your tongue."
One of the men in uniforms was on the receiving end of a glare that would have melted a lesser man into a quivering puddle. Kate looked down at the table, biting her lip in an effort to hide her smile. Senator Cruz coughed, shuffling her papers. Before she could begin speaking again, Chubbs was already midway into his next sentence.
"Let's lay this out fully, shall we?"
he began.
"Oh, Jesus,"
Liam said, looking upward for strength.
"As an 18-year-old,
Chubbs said,
"I finally have the right to choose what I want for myself. But if I make the wrong choice, I'll still be punished for it."
"Please save your questions for the end." But even as she said it, Senator Cruz made a small, almost imperceptible motion with her hands, as if to encourage him.
"I'm not finished," Chubb said. "If I were to choose to not have someone, potentially an incompetent someone, cut into my brain, the most important organ in my body, to fix it, then I'm stuck in yet another camp, this time for the rest of my life."
"Oh, I like him," Graham said, delighted.
"It's not a camp," one of the men in uniform said impatiently. "It's a community. Now can we get back to..." "A community with barbed wire fences? Armed guards? You realize that by doing this, all you're accomplishing is reinforcing in America, throughout the world, that the word different means bad, ugly, dangerous. There's no rehabilitation in that. You just want to sweep us under the rug and hope time takes care of us. I'm sorry, but that's pretty damned terrible. And clearly you know it's pretty damned terrible, because you've spent a total of 2 seconds laying out a plan that affects thousands of lives, which have already been ruined by another group of people, some of them probably in this room."
"Psi-afflicted humans have abilities that are dangerous and cannot be controlled," the man reasoned. "They can be used as tools for individuals to commit crimes, gain unfair advantages, and harm others."
"Yeah, so can a pile of money. It's what a person chooses to do with their abilities that matters. By locking someone up for making a choice about their body that they have every right to make, what you're essentially saying is that, no, you don't trust us. Not to make good choices, not to treat others well. I find that incredibly insulting. And, by the way, I seem to be in pretty good control of my abilities now, wouldn't you say?"
"You believe children as young as 8, 9, 10 should be allowed to make a life-altering decision?" Senator Cruz was feeding him a counter-argument to play off of. I sat back slightly, relieved my opinion of her hadn't been far off base. She might have been overruled by the panel she sat with now, but she had found a creative way of getting her point across.
"I'm saying that the kids who've had years of their lives stolen have had time to weigh what they would choose if the opportunity came to be cured of it," Chubb said. "They've had time to think about what they would choose and can make an educated decision. Trust me, that's all any of us ever thought about, as every hour of every day was controlled down to the minute, or when we had to struggle every day for food and water and shelter, while men and women literally hunted us. You're going to set the mark at 18, knowing that 80% of all kids previously interned at a camp can't meet that benchmark? I, at 18, was in a camp for a year. One of my best friends was in hers for 6 years, but she's only 17. She has to subject herself to a decision made by the same people who sent her away in the first place?"
I grimaced, fighting not to look over at my parents. I didn't need them feeling any guiltier than they already did.
"We need to move on from this topic," another one of the men said. "Otherwise, we won't be able to take questions."
"I agree," Dr. Gray said suddenly, then clarified, "with the young gentleman. Unless they've committed a crime, or the psychological toll of their experiences has impacted their decision-making abilities, or they've harmed someone, I believe the children we take out of the camps should be able to choose. However, parents of children who haven't reached the life or manifest threshold should be allowed to make the decision, and will need to do so before their child's 7th birthday. Her voice was strained to the point of fraying, beyond tired. The reporters ate up every single word she offered, jumping to their feet to launch a volley of questions at her, all of which could be summed up as, "Where is President Gray?" Senator Cruz stared at her notes, then asked casually, "Do you believe you could figure out a better system, given what we have to work with?"
Yes,
Chubb said without a hint of arrogance.
And I think if you proceed with this option, you'll not only be ignoring the mental and emotional health needs of the children coming out of the camps, but you'll be condemning them to a life of fear and shame. And if it's going to be that way, then you might as well have left them in the camps.
Good, Senator Cruz said. We'll reconvene our discussion on this point following the conclusion of this panel. Should any other Psi-afflicted youth like to join us, please speak to me. In the midst of all of this, someone had disappeared from the front row of seats, a young man in a baseball cap. He'd faded to the outer edge of the room and was moving quickly toward the exit. With his face turned down and his arms crossed over his chest, he could have been anyone. But I knew exactly who he was. I slipped away, waving off Liam's and Vida's questioning eyes, and held up a single finger. I had a feeling this was going to take far longer than a minute, but with Senator Cruz talking again, this time about future congressional and presidential elections, their attention was drawn back to her. The hall outside was 10 degrees cooler than the stuffy sweatbox the ballroom was becoming. I had a feeling he had come out here for the silence, though, more than the cool air. He'd walked nearly to the end of the long hall and taken a seat across from a window overlooking the hotel's parking lot.
Come to laugh, have you?
Clancy asked, his voice hoarse. He never turned his head, only kept his eyes trained on the window.
Enjoy it.
I'm not here to laugh, I said. He snorted, but said nothing. Eventually, his hands tightened in his lap, clenching and releasing.
I keep losing feeling in my right fingers. They said they'd never seen the complication before.
I bit back the reflexive, I'm sorry. I wasn't.
I told you this would happen, didn't I?
Clancy said.
That the choice all of you were stupidly chasing ended up in the hands of the people who put you away in the first place. It didn't have to be this way.
No, I said pointedly. It didn't have to. For the first time, he turned and looked directly at me. The recovery from the surgery had drained some of the meat from his bones and the color from his skin. I had a feeling that if I were to lift off the baseball cap, I'd find a newly shaved head and fresh scars hidden there.
What happened to Nico?
Well, I hadn't expected that. He's here. Didn't you see him? His shoulders rose and fell with the next deep breath he took in. Did you want to talk to him about something? I prompted. Maybe about something you regret?
I only regret losing control of the situation. But it doesn't matter. I can figure a way around this, how to deactivate the device she planted there, how to get everything back. I can do it. I'm closer to the right people than ever. I can find my father, wherever he's hiding. I can do it.
And somehow, I'd known that would be his answer. Because this is who Clancy was at his core. Someone who'd always had everything and still needed more. Still wanted the one thing he'd never, ever be able to achieve. But when he looked at me, his dark eyes sunken back into his skull, it told me something else. That maybe what he really wanted, what he couldn't admit out loud, was the exact same thing his mother had wished for all these years. Pride played a dangerous game in his heart, warring with exhaustion. I felt myself hesitate, fingers curling into fists, as I thought of all the lives he'd played with so callously, the good ones that had been lost, so that he could find ways to survive. And there, too, at the back of my mind, was the boy on the examination table, scared and alone and boiling with helpless hatred. The one with the sweet smile that now lived only in his mother's memory. I knew what he would have done if our situations had been reversed, and I couldn't deny the small voice telling me to do exactly that. Walk away.
let the pain and humiliation grow in him like a cancer until they devoured him. And that alone was a reason to reconsider, because no matter how many times he'd tried, he'd never successfully molded me in his image. And now, he never would. It wasn't to free him of his guilt. It wasn't to punish him. It wasn't anything other than an act of mercy. There were no barriers between us, no blocks. His life spilled through my mind, whirling in colors and sounds I'd never been allowed to see. I'd never been strong enough to find. I took what I could and replaced it with something better. He had never been tested on, never been in Orange, never at East River or in California. There were things I saw, secrets so horrible I'd never wish to inflict on another person by sharing them. I focused on the brightness. I left him with only that, the simple story that he had been with his mother this entire time, that he had helped her all of these years, that the love he still felt for her was a good, pure thing to hold on to. And when I turned to go, releasing his mind for the last time, he looked out the window again at the blackbirds diving and rolling around each other, fluttering across the blue sky, and he smiled. I started back down the hall again, eyes down, thoughts a mess. I didn't see the woman coming out of the ladies' room until I collided with her and ended up with a mouthful of her bright red curls. "I'm sorry," I said, untangling myself. "I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention."
"Lucky for me," the woman said, her voice low and smooth. "I've been trying to track you down for days. How's the leg, kid?"
At that, I looked up, finally realizing who this was. Alice. She'd pulled herself together today. Traded the scrubby jeans and coat I'd seen her in at the meeting point for a full suit that didn't quite fit her. Her hair was a loose, wild mane around her shoulders, held back by a pair of thick framed glasses and a pen she'd probably stuck there and forgot about. "It's been better," I said, eyeing her warily. Seeing that I didn't return her smile, she sighed.
"Look, kid, if this is about me running your story, I'm not going to apologize. I have a duty to report the facts, the truth. And the truth here is that it's a hell of a story. There are a few pieces of information you could fill in for me, if you have a second."
"I don't." Alice shifted uncomfortably, as if just remembering what I was and what I could do. She lowered her voice and glanced around to make sure no one was listening.
"I got a tip that Senator Cruz spoke to you and a few others about some kind of program. Top secret stuff."
"Ballsy of her, considering she just told that whole room that every nation is banned from using you all in any kind of military or clandestine services."
I schooled my reaction, keeping it neutral. Not yet, but I didn't doubt that the conversation was coming.
I stepped to the side, and she followed me, blocking the way again. If I hadn't been in the mood for this before, I was even less so now. "I have to warn you, I really don't respond well to being cornered."
Alice held up her hands. "All right, all right."
Her hand disappeared into the purse looped over her arm, fishing around for something. A business card.
"If you ever want to talk," she said, "you call me anytime. I'm all ears."
I waited until she disappeared back into the ballroom, then ripped the card in two and let the pieces flutter to the floor. I turned back to the ballroom just in time to see Zoo and Vida come dashing out, holding hands as they ran toward the elevators. A moment later, Liam and a harried-looking Chubbs appeared.
"Ah!"
Chubbs started to come toward me, his expression narrow.
"You should be resting that leg."
Liam released his shoulder and grabbed my hand.
"Let's go. Let's go.
What's happening?" I asked, glancing into the ballroom as we passed it. Someone was up at the podium making a speech, but the room was otherwise exactly as I'd left it.
"Jailbreak,"
Liam said, his eyes bright as the elevator opened and he drew us inside.
Trust me.
Fear released its grip on my throat as we rode the elevator all the way down to the underground garage, Liam bouncing on his heels the entire time. Chubbs eyed him warily as we were dragged back out. Liam freed a set of keys from his pocket and held the black plastic fob up, listening for the sound of the lock. Vida and Zoo appeared from behind one of the rows of cars and ran toward the beeping, flashing, dust-splattered SUV with Arizona plates.
"You are ridiculous,"
Chubbs informed him as he walked toward the car, loosening his tie. But he went anyway, the smallest hint of a smile on his face. I caught Liam's arm, hating the way his expression fell when he saw mine. "What's this about?" I knew what denial looked like, and this had shades of it, the stubborn unwillingness to acknowledge that something was wrong. Something had overturned inside of him that could never be fully righted.
"It's about..."
He ran a hand back through his hair.
"It's about how everything will be different going forward. You'll go back to Virginia with your family, and I'll go back to North Carolina with mine. And if we want to see each other, I need permission to take the car. You'll need to run it by your parents to get their okay. We'll be living with a set of rules we haven't had in years, and while there's something a little wonderful in that, I just want this. I want to forget for a little while, outrun the hurt. This one last time, I just want to go somewhere no one else can find us."
I smiled, taking his arm when he offered it. He walked us slowly, carefully, around the back of the car. He opened the door and helped me up into the front passenger seat, arranging my awkwardly bulky walking cast with care. He leaned in to buckle my seatbelt, using it as an excuse to kiss me again.
"Where are we going?"
Chubbs shouted at him as Liam ran around the back of the car to the driver's side door.
"Quiet, dear,"
Vida said mildly, resting a hand on his leg.
"Yes, dear,"
Chubbs grumbled back. Next to them, Zoo beamed. I was still smiling when Liam buckled himself in and turned to address the group.
"Okay, team, where to? I figure we have about an hour before the conference ends, and for once, we've got gas to burn."
"Is this how you got around before?" Vida wondered aloud. "It is a miracle you dumbasses survived."
"Told you,"
Chubbs mumbled. I reached back and smacked his arm.
"Fine. Okay. Where does everyone want to go?"
"Beach, beach, beach, beach,"
Zoo chanted.
Not sure there's one nearby, so we'll have to take a rain check on that one. Anyone else?"
Liam asked.
"Vote?"
"I don't care," I said, leaning my head back against the seat. "Can we just get lost and see where that lands us?"
"Darlin', that is the best damn idea I've heard in a long time. Your navigator, tell me when and where to turn."
He turned the keys in the ignition, letting out a
"Yes!"
as an Allman Brothers song came pouring out of the speakers. By the time we rolled up the ramp and out of the parking garage, even Chubbs's groans had turned to laughter. We drove, winding through the city streets until we found green, tree-lined roads, making our way toward the lazy lines of the river that ran along the curved spine of the city. Liam glanced over at me, taking a break from his off-key crooning. Lit by the warm afternoon sunlight, his fingers entwined with mine over the center console. Zoo rocked in time to the music, chattering excitedly about each and every sign we passed. Chubbs slid a book out of the back seat pocket in front of him, examining the cover for a moment before flipping it open. His fingers absently tapped the cracked spine to the beat as Vida leaned against his shoulder and closed her eyes. I brought my window down, letting my free hand drift out to catch the wind, and the open road rolled out in front of us. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of In the Afterlight by Alexandra Bracken. Copyright 2014 by Alexandra Bracken. Performed by Amy McFadden. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Mitch Anderson. Performance copyright 2014 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved.